Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, Ben Ritz, Director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future, and Brian Riedel, a Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, will be joining me to discuss Ritz's article in Forbes titled How Deficits Could Cripple the Biden Agenda and How He Can Overcome Them, as well as Riedel's article in the National Review titled Spending, Tax, and Deficit Myths Exposed. We will talk to Ritz and Riedel individually and then bring them together to talk with them corporately as we wade through areas of agreement and disagreement. Since we have a packed agenda for this program, however, we're going to jump right into our first conversation with Ben Ritz and Bob Bixby. Bob is the Concord Coalition's executive director and a regular contributor on the show. Ben is director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future. Prior to joining PPI, Ben staffed the Bipartisan Policy Center's Commission on Retirement Security and Personal Savings, and he worked on other federal budget issues at BPC, including sequestration, budget process reform, and the federal debt limit. Before that, he was actually a colleague of ours, the legislative outreach director for the Concord Coalition. Welcome to Facing the Future, Bob and Ben.
Thank you, Chase.
Thanks for having me. Happy to have you both here. We're talking today about, actually a rather brief segment, talking about an article that you wrote that appeared in Forbes, Ben, touching on how deficits could impact an incoming Biden administration. In fact, you went so far as to say Biden would need to leverage his unique ability to work across the aisle and demonstrate that his objectives can be accomplished in a fiscally responsible way. What I took from that is you think fiscal responsibility still matters. So I'm actually happy about that. Why do you think the deficit is still significant enough to worry about in an incoming administration?
So I'll put a little asterisk on it and say that I think that in the short term, from a substantive policy perspective, I think the deficit is not probably something that should be Biden's top concern when he comes in. I think he's going to have to prioritize COVID relief and stimulating the economy. That's the most immediate priority. But I think there are two reasons why he's going to have to care about the deficit. The first is that after we get to the other side of the recovery, and I am hopeful that that will happen, within his first term, there is the potential for interest rates to start rising again, inflation to come back, and we also have these long-term challenges with programs like Social Security and Medicare. Actually, were long-term challenges. They're starting to become sooner challenges. The Medicare Trust Fund, the Hospital Insurance Trust Fund, is going to exhaust before the end of his first term, and the Social Security Trust Funds are going to exhaust within the next decade. So I think that those are medium to long-term challenges that he will have to address after COVID. But the reason it might matter in the short term too is because we did not get a very large majority in Congress. The Democrats did not get a large majority in Congress in the midterms. We're pending two runoff elections in Georgia, but at best, we're looking at a 50-50 Senate and a very narrow Democratic House majority. And so even though the deficit may not matter economically in the short term, Republicans are going to make an issue of it in the short term, the same way they did under President Obama and the same way they have recently. And so I think that's going to force him to at least acknowledge it.
And in that same Forbes article, you come out and say that you feel Republicans will probably, using deficit concerns, work against a larger COVID-19 relief package. I'm gonna avoid the political judgment there on whether that's accurate or not, but I do want to ask you, what common ground is there on additional COVID relief? And are we likely to see something in the near term, early next year? How's this all going to play out in your mind?
So I don't know how it's going to play out. I have some possible ways that I think it could play out, but I don't know which of them is most likely. So we saw that when the Trump administration was trying to negotiate a package with Speaker Pelosi, they were negotiating a package in the vicinity of $1.8 trillion that I think is probably about what would be right for our economy. Maybe it's a little extra, but there's a lot of uncertainty here. So they were negotiating around that number, and McConnell said that was just a non-starter for him. And that's under a Republican president. And so I think that it is very unlikely that now facing a Biden White House that he has much less political incentive to cooperate with. I think it's going to be very difficult for us to get even that kind of deal. However, he did over the summer offer as a starting point for discussions a $1 trillion deal called the HEALS Act. I was not a fan. I thought at the time that it was too small, and I thought that there were the way it was spent was not quite the way I think that we should be stimulating the economy. I don't think it was as effective as it could be, but I think that the prospect for a $1 trillion deal, him having put that number out there, I would be hopeful that McConnell and Speaker Pelosi could negotiate a deal of some kind in that vicinity to get us through the next couple months. And then maybe President-elect Biden and McConnell could negotiate a follow-up bill after he takes office. So I think that's probably the best possible outcome. I have no idea how likely it is.
Okay, well, let's pivot from the short-term COVID relief to the longer-term agenda. The way that I understand it is that President-elect Biden wants to separate out his longer-term policies between things that need to stimulate the economy and which wouldn't need to be paid for under PAYGO, for example, pay-as-you-go, and a longer-term agenda that would need to be paid for in his view of it. Do you think that, I mean, what are you hearing from the Hill, from Democrats, about maintaining PAYGO? Because it's become a very controversial thing within the party. I remember when President Obama came in, he was in favor of extending the Bush tax cuts for middle-income people and below. And a lot of people on the Democratic side had been arguing that anything needed to be paid for. They all needed to be paid for. The net result was that when President Obama said they didn't need to be paid for, it sort of undermined that whole case that Ken Conrad and John Spratt had been making. So I'm wondering, we're coming into a new Democratic administration. What's the future of PAYGO? How might it be amended or applied?
Oh, well, that's a really good question. So some of the ways it could play out is we could see them maintain PAYGO as they have in this Congress and just waive it for emergency COVID spending. That's how we handled the CARES Act and all these other pieces of emergency legislation. And so I don't think there is any reason that PAYGO has to stifle his Build Back Better agenda as long as we're able to use those emergency designations. They could relax PAYGO. So maybe they don't apply it as much to public investments in combating climate change and infrastructure that arguably have a longer term benefit. And then I guess in the most extreme case, they could get rid of PAYGO. But I think that's probably less likely given the constituency it has among some of the blue dogs and other moderate members of Congress.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to do either way, because if you stick to PAYGO, it would require tax increases. I'm pretty sure you couldn't offset a large agenda by cutting other spending by that much. So he's been pretty clear, President-elect Biden, that tax increases would be on the table. So that would be, obviously, that would run up against Republican opposition. So it's going to be very difficult in this environment, I would think, to pursue some large agenda.
And one more question, Ben, before we jump out of this segment. You mentioned in that article in Forbes that President-elect Biden could work to address short and long-term fiscal needs by using something called a fiscal switch. So just very briefly, what is that and how would it work?
So the fiscal switch is a concept that says that the right fiscal policy is not the same at all times. In our current environment, we need deficit finance stimulus to support the economy. But when we're back at, you know, 4% unemployment and we have these longer term fiscal challenges, we need to start looking at addressing those structural problems and have a more deficit reduction focused mindset. And so what the fiscal switch idea is, it's a roadmap from getting from one point to the other. So we start out and we say, how long do we need stimulus to go? You know, until the pandemic is resolved, until we get back to a certain unemployment rate. And as long as that's the case, we want to increase the generosity of unemployment insurance benefits, provide aid to state and local governments, and support struggling businesses as needed. Then as the economy recovers, we start phasing down that stimulus when it's no longer needed to support the economy. That's the second phase of the fiscal switch. And then in the final phase, once the economy is really backfiring on all cylinders, we pivot to deficit reduction. And we view this as a framework that will make it easier for Republicans to go along with stimulus, knowing that it's not going to be a permanent deficit spigot in perpetuity. And Democrats will be more comfortable with the prospect of future deficit reduction, knowing that it won't prematurely cut off stimulus like deficit reduction efforts did following the financial crisis.
So that's kind of a fiscal bait and switch.
Gee, what a great way to leave this segment there, Bob. This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Ben Ritz, Director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future. We discussed how deficits could impact a Biden administration. Up next, Brian Riedel, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, will join me and Bob to discuss common fiscal policy related myths. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Bob Bixby and Brian Riedel. Bob is the Concord Coalition's executive director, a regular contributor on the show. Brian is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and he focuses on budget, tax, and economic policy. He's also worked as chief economist to Senator Rob Portman, a staff director of the Senate Finance Subcommittee on Fiscal Responsibility and Economic Growth, director of budget and spending policy for Marco Rubio's presidential campaign, and he was the lead architect of the 10-year deficit reduction plan for Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. Brian also served as the Heritage Foundation's lead research fellow on federal budget and spending policy. And in that capacity, he participated in the fiscal wake-up tour, which Bob also participated in. Welcome to Facing the Future, Bob and Brian.
Thank you, Chase. Thank you.
Happy to have you both here. Brian, we're going to take on a similar segment that we did with Ben Ritz and hone in for a few minutes on something you recently published. And that was an article in the National Review titled Spending, Tax, and Deficit Myths Exposed. So we're going to spend a few minutes talking about some of the myths that you highlighted. And I'm just going to jump right in since we have limited time. You say one of the myths, and we're not going to get to all of them, so I'd encourage people to read your publication, but you say soaring defense spending drives deficits is actually a myth. Why is that? I mean, we spend more on defense than many other countries combined. So how is that not a significant factor?
We definitely spend more on defense than other countries, and we surely spend more on defense than a lot of individuals would prefer. But mathematically speaking, it has been declining as a share of GDP. In the 80s and 90s, in the 70s and 80s, we spent 5.7% of GDP. And as late as 2010, we were spending 4.6% of GDP on defense. It has since declined down to 3% of GDP. And in a decade, it's going to fall to about 2.9%, which is only 1% of GDP above Europe's NATO target, where they spend about 2%. So overall, when you get a declining percent of GDP from 6 to 3, you're actually going to be at the lowest share of GDP since the 1930s. More broadly speaking, defense right now is about 15% of federal spending, which is the lowest it's ever been. So again, you can want defense spending to be less. I'm not saying what the magic number is, but the reason spending is going to rise drastically as a share of GDP over the next 30 years is not because defense is rising, when in fact, as a share of GDP, it's significantly falling.
Well, let's stay on deficit drivers for a second. You also say, and it's a popular topic, whether good or bad, that the 2017 tax cuts are not driving deficits. How is that possible? I mean, I've heard that that severely undercut long-term or maybe even near-term tax revenue.
the tax cuts do cost money. Despite the argument that tax cuts pay for themselves, these tax cuts, if extended, are about $200 billion a year, $250 billion a year. So they are contributing to budget deficits, but they're not a lead driver. You know, between 2016 and 2030, if the tax cuts are extended, the deficit's going to go from $600 billion a year to $2 trillion. That's $1.4 trillion a year in rising deficits. But the tax cuts are only about $200 billion of that. So the tax cuts are driving about 1/7 or 1/6 of the deficit increase over this period. The bigger driver is general revenue transfers to Social Security and Medicare and the related interest costs. That's what's going to rise by about $1.2 trillion over that period. So it's not that tax cuts don't contribute to the deficit. It's not that they're not part of the story. And it's not that we necessarily have to keep every tax cut. But just mathematically speaking, it's only driving about 1/6 or 1/7 of the rise in deficits between 2016 and 2030.
On the defense thing, that comes up a lot. I think that, and I had somebody come up to me, a professor at a school that will not be named, come up to me and insist after one of our fiscal wake-up tour events that we were misleading people about the defense budget because it was half of the budget. And this, you know, and I said, well, no, it's a, you know, it's not. It's, you know, well below 20% at that point. And no, she insisted that it was half of the budget. And I thought, well, okay, you know, I don't know what her students are learning. But anyway, but that factoid comes from looking just at the discretionary spending part of the budget. So if you think that the budget is just discretionary spending, which is, we all know, is about a third of the budget, then defense is about half of that. And so the context, I find, is just so important when people come up with these factoids. You don't understand the full story. In that regard, let me pivot to one other myth that we get all the time, which is the waste, fraud, and abuse foreign aid myth. People seem to have way exaggerated views of the size of foreign aid in the federal budget. And the extent to which the federal budget consists of waste, fraud, and abuse.
Absolutely. People look for easy answers, whether it's cutting just tax loopholes or cutting waste.
And it's there. We all know it's there, but it's not half the budget.
It's also not a line item, so you can't just point to it and be like, well, that's the waste, fraud, and abuse.
Yeah, waste. I always thought that that would be fun. If there was a waste, fraud, and abuse line item in the budget, you could, you know, just sort of plan
on it. I'd be curious to see who would keep it in the budget. You know, if that's there, you're like, oh, no, that's totally fine, everyone. So something we harp on in the field, Brian, is the need for tough choices on fiscal policy to get us on a more sustainable long-term path. A couple of myths, I'm going to get a twofer out of this one. A couple of myths you highlight is one that President Bill Clinton at the time and Newt Gingrich, they had courageous reforms that balanced the budget in the 90s. You say that's a myth. And you also said President Obama aggressively cutting deficits, also a myth. So how are those two things myths? You know, we're always looking for strong leadership on fiscal policy. Did they fall short? Was something else involved? How are these possibly myths?
The danger is when people simply look at the trend of the deficit without looking at what caused the deficit to get bigger or smaller. And then they prematurely give blame or credit to politicians for things that they don't really have much responsibility for. In terms of the 1980s, we did get balanced budgets under President Clinton with Newt Gingrich as Speaker of the House. But from the era of the peak deficit to the peak surplus, 80% of the deficit reduction was stuff that politicians really had nothing to do with. 80% of the deficit reduction was defense savings from the end of the Cold War, which had already happened before they took those positions, and the current revenue bubble from the economic bubble of the late 1990s. 80% of it was things that Clinton and Gingrich had nothing to do with. The final 20% were the Clinton tax hikes and the Gingrich spending cuts. And of course, the reason we had deficits afterwards is starting in 2002 is that the defense savings got blown up by the war by 9/11 and the revenue bubble burst. So those two factors that were driving the deficit reduction reverse, you go automatically from surpluses back to deficits. You also had some big tax cuts. Under President Obama, it is true the deficit fell. When he was elected, the deficit had already spiked from $160 billion to $1.2 trillion just because of the recession. What CBO said at the time was that if we do nothing, nothing at all, the recession will end in 6 months and the deficit will automatically drop back down to about $250 billion within a couple of years. Well, instead, we got a lot of stimulus spending, a lot of proposals that were quite expensive. You can agree that those are great ideas and the economy needed it, but it did increase the deficit. The deficit went up to $1.4 trillion in 2009 and stayed above $1 trillion per year through 2012, never fell below $438 billion again. So if you compare the deficit to the actual baseline of what was going to happen automatically, we got about $5 trillion in higher deficits under President Obama than the baseline. So while the deficit fell, it actually fell slower than it would have otherwise naturally. I'm not saying that these policies weren't good ideas. That's a separate discussion. But I'm just saying, mathematically speaking, the deficit was supposed to have fallen faster according to the inherited baseline than it had.
You say the federal tax code is becoming less progressive. That's a myth. I almost feel like Maury Povich. That was a lie. How is it a myth that the federal tax code is becoming less progressive?
If you just look at the CBO data, the highest earning one-fifth of households now pay 87% of all federal income taxes and 69% of all combined federal taxes, which are much higher than 40 years ago. If you look at it by what tax rate the individuals pay, what's happened is the top 1% has paid about a 32% tax rate for the last 40 years. The top one-fifth have paid a 26% tax rate. So they've actually paid about the same, but everybody in the bottom 80% has seen their tax rates drop. So if everybody in the bottom 80% is seeing lower tax rates, then just by proportion, a higher proportion of the revenue is going to the top 1% or top 20%. And yes, even if you adjust for income inequality, even if you adjust for the fact that the rich are earning more of the revenue or earning more of the income, they're still paying a higher portion of the federal taxes, even adjusted for income inequality. And we actually have the most progressive tax code in the entire OECD adjusted for income inequality. So maybe you can say the rich should even pay even more, but the reality is the tax code is becoming more progressive than it had been before.
This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Brian Riedel, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. We discussed common fiscal policy myths. Up next, Brian, Bob, and Ben Ritz will be back as we have a lively conversation on fiscal policy from, frankly, different political perspectives. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Bob Bixby, Brian Riedel, and Ben Ritz. Bob is Concord's executive director, a regular contributor. Ben is the director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future and a former Concord Coalition colleague. Brian is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, an economist, and former member of the Fiscal Wake Up Tour with Bob. You heard from Brian and Ben separately. Now we're bringing the whole band together. Welcome back to Facing the Future, Bob, Brian, and Ben.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Happy to have you here. And since we did two separate segments with each of you, I want to ask really where you have common ground or even where you find agreement or disagreement on some of the assertions made in the two articles that we were discussing. I'm going to start with you, Ben. Do you agree with many of Brian's assessments on what are considered fiscal policy myths, or do you have strong opinions on some of them?
Sure. I think he is. I think all of them are technically right. And I think most of them are substantively right, too. I think the one thing that I would probably disagree with is the characterization of the tax cuts. And I think the reason for that is that in his myths, he was talking mostly about the Trump tax cuts. But I kind of look at it a little more holistically. And I think about the Trump tax cuts compounded with the Bush tax cuts. And if you look at them together, they play a much larger role in the deficits we've had. And I think that if you look forward looking at the drivers of our deficit, I agree that they are the growing deficit is likely to be Social Security and Medicare driven. But I think that the deficits we've had for the last 20 years were really mostly stimulus and tax cuts. And then the another point that sort of stems from that is if you look at the Obama record, he of that $5 trillion he added to the debt, roughly, I think it was $3 or $4 trillion was making the Bush tax cuts permanent. And so if you just look at Obama originated policy, and if you also take the stimulus out, then it ends up being much, much smaller. And so I think that everything he said was technically right. And I don't disagree with any of his numbers. I just think that we should have a really holistic view of, you know, when we've compounded tax cut on top of tax cut, it's played a pretty significant role.
So Brian, I want to give you a chance. Do you agree with Ben's assessment? Should we be looking beyond the Trump tax cuts in terms of how tax cuts are impacting short and long-term budget deficits?
Well, I'm going to take the position that I was right. This is very controversial. You know, my take on the tax cuts, well, first, in terms of, you know, I mean, I'm going to say this is not really a disagreement with Ben, because Ben is talking about the last 20 years. I'm going to talk about the 2000 to 2050 period. For that 50-year period, Social Security and healthcare are going to rise by 8.4% of GDP, which dwarfs, you know, about the 1.5% of GDP we had in the 2001 tax cuts and the other 1% of GDP tax cut that we had in 2017. We still have Social Security and healthcare about four times bigger. I will say some of the what these tax cuts are doing, it's easy to say, well, without the deficit would be smaller, but part of the reason that they cut taxes is because the baseline revenues are rising so quickly due to what's called real bracket creep, which is when your income grows faster than inflation, which pushes you into higher tax brackets. And so it's a long way of saying we kind of have a baseline that automatically raises taxes in a way. And so in some ways it is correct that without these tax cuts, the deficit would be smaller, but without the tax cuts, we would have also had what actually would have been a tax burden that would be substantially higher than anything we've ever had in American history before, going up to say 20-21, you know, a percent of GDP. So it's true. If we allowed taxes to keep rising, we'd have a smaller deficit, although we'd still have a big deficit with Social Security and healthcare. But a portion of the taxes were just kind of tax cuts were offsetting what's called real bracket creep, which I think makes them somewhat more affordable. Although I still take the position that at least the 2017 tax cuts should have been paid for.
I wanted to get back to a very, very fundamental point. Aside from policy issues like taxes or healthcare spending, when we did the fiscal wake-up tour, one of the central elements was that everybody agreed that deficits matter, that the long-term projected unsustainability of the federal debt was a problem, and it could be addressed from different perspectives, from the left or from the right, different mix of taxes or spending, but that we couldn't just let the deficit run the way it was projected to do. And I wanted to get your take on that central premise, because we're seeing unprecedented deficits in debt right now. And it has gotten some people to think, well, geez, maybe deficits don't matter after all. So I wanted to get you both to just address that point about why deficits matter, to what extent, and I'm not talking about like in the way abstract. It's just like, is it something that policymakers should be thinking about, whether the incoming Biden administration should be thinking about it, whether the Republican opposition should be thinking about it? I mean, I not just way out, but I mean, is it a current issue? And I'm not talking about COVID.
Right.
We're going to exempt COVID.
Right.
I'm talking about policy assuming post-pandemic.
Right. Okay. So policy post-pandemic, I think the deficit does matter, mainly because it's about hedging risk. I think that if you look at the share of our debt burden, what it's likely to look at in the future, some people will look at that and say, well, interest, as long as the interest rates are low, we can afford to carry this debt burden in perpetuity. It's not a threat. And even if that were true, and under TBO's current baseline, it's not true. But if you believe that interest rates are going to be even lower than CBO, you can make the argument that it is sustainable. The problem I see there is that it's taking a really big gamble, sort of on the order of magnitude of what we did with climate change in the 90s, where we say, well, you know, it might be true, but it might not be true. And, you know, we'll kind of see what happens. And the risks are asymmetric. If you run responsible fiscal policy, and again, we're talking about outside of a recession, so there's not really a great economic harm in running responsible, you know, small deficits when you or balanced budgets when the economy is operating at full capacity. And it turns out that interest rates aren't that high, it's not a huge deal. Whereas if you accrue this giant debt burden and you're wrong about interest rates, then you have a really big problem in the future and it becomes extremely difficult to keep your obligations. And that just creates an impossible situation for policymakers. And so I think
kind of like jumping out of the plane and hoping that your parachute opens, and what happens if it doesn't. So Brian, I think there's some openings here to talk about this giant gamble on interest.
Yeah, I mean, right now, CBO assumes that the debt is going to rise to 195% of GDP in 30 years, and that's with low interest rates. That assumes that the interest rate never rises above 4.4% ever again, which is even lower than it was as late as 2008. And given the fact that debt by itself should raise interest rates, it should actually be a driver of interest rates, 4.4% is optimistic. Let's say that interest rates exceed the CBO projections by one percentage point. Let's say they rise to 5.4% instead of 4.4%. In that instance, you add $30 trillion in interest cost over 30 years. You raise the 30-year debt from 195% of GDP to 264% of GDP. At that point, the budget deficit in 30 years is 17% of GDP. Now, usually for context, the government spends about 21 and taxes about 17. We would be running a deficit of 17% of GDP. This is just if you exceed the baseline by one percentage point and still have interest rates that are not significantly above historical averages. So as Ben said, the question is, are we feeling lucky? Do we want to gamble our entire fiscal future, our entire economic future, on the hope that interest rates never rise to 4, 5, 6% ever again? The cost, if we're wrong, is calamitous, because once you've already made the expenditures, you've locked in the big spending levels, you've locked in the lower tax levels, you're running deficits of 15% of GDP, it's really hard to unwind all of that.
And I eventually want to get back to giving Brian a chance to jump in and assess Ben's opinion on some things, but I think this is an incredibly important topic, so I want to stay on it for just a couple more minutes. I've got to wonder, are low interest rates, which sound good, are they an indicator of economic health?
Well, I think if interest rates do remain at 1% or 2% for the next 30 or 40 years, it means that we have had a pretty weak economy. It means that productivity has remained low, economic growth has remained low, that the Federal Reserve has really had to keep trying to goose the economy by keeping interest rates low. I'm not sure that that's something that you want. And keep in mind, in that situation, if the economy is doing that badly, you're actually going to lose tax revenue and you're going to have certain programs cost even more. So in that situation, you might end up with higher deficits in other areas. I'm not sure that that's a situation that you want. You know, I'll also add, the consensus economic research says that adding 100% of GDP in debt should raise interest rates 4 points. Well, right now we pay a 2% interest rate on our debt. By itself, the debt should raise it to 6% just by itself. So the question is, are the factors that have been holding down debt, are they going to keep accelerating? Is low productivity going to get lower? Is the Federal Reserve going to get even more dovish? Are these factors going to keep holding interest rates down and accelerating? It's a risk.
So I think I largely agree with most of what Brian said. I think the one other point I'll raise is that I think that you could see a scenario in which it's not outrageous to say, let's see what happens with interest rates and inflation before we do significant deficit reduction. But the problem is we can't really do that the way our budget is structured, because so much of our spending is programmed in advance on particularly programs like Social Security and Medicare, that people plan their lives around decades in advance. If we are in a situation where interest rates and inflation are suddenly starting to rise, that creates a really difficult challenge in which we are having to tell people that the benefits they've planned around are going to get cut suddenly, or you're putting the entire burden of deficit reduction on younger workers, despite the fact that, you know, the previous generation really got a great deal by not fully financing the government for previous years. And so I think that if we had a more flexible investment-focused budget that could turn on a dime, then we could afford to take some of these risks a little more. But if we're going to plan the budget so far in advance and have people plan their lives around it, then I think it's important that we're not subjecting it to these potentially steep, sharp, sudden changes.
So I do want to take a second to go back and give Brian a chance to examine Ben's thoughts on his recent Forbes article. And I want to take a specific, not really intended to be a political bent, but it's probably going to end up going that route because, I mean, Ben, you said that effectively many Republican policymakers are using our current fiscal policy situation as reason to push back against a significant COVID relief package. So, Brian, to you, do you think that's a fair characterization of what's actually happening? And should that be the approach right now? Should there be pushback on additional COVID relief, or should we be full steam ahead?
You know, I talk to a lot of Republican offices. I talk to a lot of Republican staffers. I've had conversations with Republican senators. There is agreement that we need additional legislation to rescue the economy. And there is agreement that it does not need to be paid for, and that should not be a concern. I think the people who say that we should do absolutely zero going forward, I think in Congress you can count on one hand. I think that there is a push for more. The area of disagreement, I think, between Republicans and Democrats right now is how much do we need and how much is effective. I think the Democratic approach, the original Democratic approach last summer of after the CARES Act, of the HEROES Act, was more of the $2 to $3 trillion Keynesian bazooka that was just spray money around and make sure that everyone has as everything to increase demand. And the Republican approach is more targeted. It's we need to help out those in need, but we don't want to spend a dollar more than is necessary given our fiscal situation. So I think the Republican approach is a little more narrow on focus on the pandemic, focus on the people who are unemployed, the people who have lost their job, small businesses in need, smaller amounts for states. There's a lot of disagreement on state and local governments. I understand that a lot of people on the left think we need a lot more. I just think the Republican position is that something narrow, $500 billion, $600-700 billion is probably sufficient right now. Certainly with an unemployment rate at 6.9%, the solution is not what you would have if the unemployment rate were 14%. And so I'm hoping they can come together on a plan during the lame duck. I would love, you know, I'd love to see a plan, $500 billion, $600 billion. They also need to extend unemployment benefits, which are going to expire in a couple months. I think that's a very top priority. It's just matters of the fact that a lot of conservatives don't particularly agree with the Keynesian bazooka approach and really want to see a lot more narrow reforms.
So Ben, I've got to imagine you have some kind of response, agree or disagree.
I would say mixed. I totally understand where he's coming from on the HEROES Act. And I think that he makes a good point about what's appropriate at 14% is not what's appropriate at 6.9%. And when the HEROES Act was first crafted, the economy looked like it was going to be in a lot worse position than it is right now. I thought that the HEROES Act was on the larger side back then. I think now it's way bigger than we need. And I think that's very obvious to almost all of us. I don't think that I would agree that $500, $600 billion is enough. I think that especially that this, given that this is a one-time expense, not a recurring one, and interest rates are low, I think that the approach of not a dollar more than is necessary, I think that we should err on the side of being more generous rather than potentially under-stimulating the economy and leaving some people out to suffer in the recession when they don't have to. But I think, you know, there's a middle ground here. And one thing that we've been advocating a lot at PPI is this concept of automatic stabilizers. And this ties in with the fiscal switch, where instead of trying to do the $3 trillion and guess the number several months back, where we don't really know how it's going to play out. And right now you could have the opposite problem where we do too little and it ends up being worse than expected. Let's figure out the parameters for what level of unemployment justifies what level of support, program that in advance, and then let it run its course. If the COVID recession ends up being worse than we're expecting, spend more money. And if it ends up having a robust recovery, spend less. And let's let the economic indicators dictate where we go instead of the political whims.
Ben and I have both written articles on the automatic stabilizer issue. I think that there's a lot of common ground here. You know, my proposal, which didn't originally come from me, other people have proposed the same thing, is combine automatic increases in things like unemployment benefits and SNAP during recessions with automatic deficit reducers during booms. Not just a matter of expiring the recessionary increases, but actually structural reforms during economic expansions to help address the deficit as well. I think you'll find a lot more conservative support for the automatic stabilizers in recessions if they can be assured that we're going to do a little more fiscal responsibility during booms, you know, in terms of fixing the deficit over the business cycle.
One thing that I will note is I remember when Brian published that piece, because I was working on the fiscal switch at the same time, and he beat me by like a day. But I also I cited his op-ed in making the argument that I thought that the fiscal switch would make automatic stabilizers more palatable to conservatives. So I think that on this issue, you know, you've seen that we kind of disagree a little bit about the levels, but not really the structure of how this should go. There's potential common ground there.
This is such a common sense bipartisan proposal that it would surely have no chance in Congress.
The thing about the automatic stabilizers is that nobody, politicians can't take credit or, you know, for doing it. I mean, one thing that I have a question about in that with automatic stabilizers, and when we talk about programs, we complain about them being on autopilot. So this is a good autopilot, I guess you're saying, but is there a problem with putting even more of the budget on autopilot?
I think it's okay if you're taking, if part of the autopilot is making reductions during booms. That's why I would be nervous putting spending increases during recessions on autopilot if we weren't putting spending and possibly tax changes on autopilot during booms as well, because then the overall effect, I think, on autopilot is not to enlarge the deficit, but to at least hold it constant or reduce it. And in terms of that on autopilot, I mean, the 1983 Social Security reforms put a lot of savings proposals on autopilot for a period of 45 years, like higher eligibility age. So I think you can put savings on autopilot over long term as well.
I think that it's okay to do things on autopilot if you are tying it to the right indicators. So part of the problem we have with the way our current budget is on autopilot is that it's the taxes aren't tied to the spending, and it's not tied to the state of the economy, and it's not tied to interest rates or inflation or any of these things that we are concerned about being unsustainable. And also it is autopilot so many years in advance that it's very difficult to change, like an ocean liner. Whereas I think if you do the automatic stabilizers and programs like unemployment on autopilot, you know, the big changes are hopefully going to be short-lived in response to real economic changes that determine what the right level of deficit is. And if they end up being wrong, Congress can change them, and they can change them during a boom time when they won't be as politically charged. So I think I understand the concern about putting too much of the budget on autopilot, but I think this is one area where we need the policy to be more responsive than our political system can be, and it would be beneficial to do so.
This is Facing the Future. I've been talking to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, Brian Riedel, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and Ben Ritz, Director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Center for Funding America's Future. We've been discussing fiscal policy-related myths, pandemic relief, and a whole lot more. Thanks for joining the show, Bob, Brian, and Ben.
Thank you, Chase.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.